Listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples.
The lessons here is that defeating the kind of fascism we face now requires something deeper than defeating the current administration or winning elections. But it requires a deeper ideological shift. That means thinking beyond nation and pledging allegiance, not to Israel, not to the United States, but to the world and all life, all living things. It means standing up for the oppressed everywhere, right? That's what solidarity means.
That's Robin R.D. Kelly, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Robin D.G. Kelly, Solidarity and Black Resistance to Fascism and Genocide. Langston Hughes, the great African-American poet, said decades ago, "Fascism is a new name for the kind of terror the Negro has always faced in America. Fascism can and has led to genocide. Progressive African-American intellectuals, writers, poets, musicians have had a long tradition and history of solidarity and resisting fascism and genocide, from Frederick Douglass to Gil Scott-Heron, from Sojourner Truth to Angela Davis, from W.E.B. Du Bois to John Lewis, from Paul Robeson to Amiri Baraka, from Ida B. Wells to Malcolm X, from Ella Baker to Dr. King, from Harry Belafonte to Sonny Rollins, from James Baldwin to Cornel West, and up to the present moment where Robin D.G. Kelly warns we're witnessing the consolidation of a fascist police state. Our guest today is Robin D.G. Kelly. He's professor of history at UCLA, a distinguished scholar, public intellectual, and award-winning author. Among his many books are Race Rebels, Thelonious Monk, and Freedom Dreams. He spoke at UMass Amherst in April 2025. And now, Robin D.G. Kelly.
So I want to begin with where we are now. Let me start with the recent story about someone MAGA leaders call an American hero, a patriot. So on May 8, 2023, the ex-Marine Daniel Penny choked to death an unarmed, unhoused black man named Jordan Neely on a Manhattan subway train. Now, Neely was deemed a threat because he shouted, "I want food, I'm not taking no for an answer, I don't mind going to jail and getting life in prison, I'm ready to die." Now, you all know the story, I'm not going to repeat that. Penny was arrested 11 days later, but only after public pressure forced the police to arrest him. Wealthy Republicans gave generously to his defense fund. He raised like $2.8 million in 6 weeks. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, which is like the second most embarrassing graduate of Yale University, you called him a good Samaritan. And you're like, who's first? J.D. Vance, right? So he called Penny a good Samaritan, which, you know, it's a bizarre association when you think about it, given the fact he's Catholic and clearly hadn't read the Bible, because Jesus' parable of the Good Samaritan, he stops and helps a man who had been badly beaten and robbed, bandaging his wounds, housing and caring for him when others pass him by, you know? So Daniel Penny killed the suffering man in need, and for this he was rewarded. He walked out of the courtroom on December 9th, 2024, a free man, richer than he had ever been, and a darling of the MAGA movement. 5 days later, Trump invites Penny to watch the annual Army-Navy football game in his luxury box. And who is he joined by? Elon Musk, Ron DeSantis, and J.D. Vance, who wrote on social media, "It was a scandal Penny was ever prosecuted in the first place." Now, of course, this is a repeat of Kyle Rittenhouse, who received, you know, the same kind of treatment for killing two unarmed Black Lives Matter protesters in Wisconsin in 2020. The right poured $2 million into his war chest. Trump praised him and invited him to the White House. And in fact, it came out later, Trump ordered federal law enforcement to say positive things about Rittenhouse to the press. And Bill Ackman, which is the man who's trying to make Harvard white again, called Rittenhouse a patriot. Now, in February of this year, Andreessen Horowitz, a leading Silicon Valley venture capital firm, hired Daniel Penny, having no prior experience in finance. In fact, Mark Andreessen, co-founder of the firm, he had given the Trump campaign like $3 million, both in a super PAC and directly to his campaign. And he also continues to provide vital support for Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency. Now, tall, fit, blonde-haired, chiseled figures, features, he's the Aryan ideal. Daniel Penny was the perfect symbol for America's fascist turn under Trump and Project 2025's plan to dismantle much of the administrative state, curtail civil liberties, concentrate power in the executive branch, and redistribute wealth upwards. Now, Penny embodied the kind of pared-down muscular state, right? Operating alone, above the law, willing to do what it takes to annihilate the threat. And that threat, of course, is an unhoused, disabled, so-called violent Black man. Jordan Neely represented all that was wrong with America. Dependency, entitlements, Black criminality, liberal constraints on law enforcement, DEIA, even the existence of public transportation. Penny represented the will and the vision of the Heritage Foundation and a cabal of unelected billionaires committed to eliminating the social safety net, workers' bargaining rights, affordable health care, public health safeguards, enforcement of civil and disability rights, academic freedom, investment in renewable energy, regulations on pollution and fossil fuel extraction, as well as criminalizing anti-racism, anti-sexism, and trans-identity. Rising white nationalism, racist violence, xenophobia, and the economic deterioration of the working class prepared the way for Trump's second term and the imminent reality we're facing right now. Project 2025 and the alt-right, their roots go back to Charles Koch. If you look at, you know, the origins of the Institute for Humane Studies in 1961, for example, or Murray Rothbard, or Charles Murray and Richard Herrnstein, who were authors of The Bell Curve, that claimed race explained IQ differences. Now, these cats believe in eugenics. Okay, this is very important. They believed in human diversity, right? But human diversity as fixed, immutable, and hierarchical. They insisted that some groups or stocks, right, were not suitable for freedom or self-rule precisely because of their genetic makeup. So consider at least three people who actually contributed to Project 2025. Okay. Dr. Jason Richwine, doctor, remember, got a PhD, doesn't make you smart. he argued that Latinx people had lower IQs than white people and proposed using IQ tests to determine immigrant entry into the United States. And he was just appointed to a very high-ranking position at the National Institute of Standards and Technology. Corey Stewart, a failed GOP Senate candidate from Virginia, defender of the Confederacy and the Confederate flag, he had direct ties to Jason Kessler, who organized the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville in 2017. Now, Richard I don't know why I can't say this, because he disturbs me so much. Hanania, who promoted eugenics and forced sterilization of low IQ people, which he suggested were mostly Black people. Actually, I know why I can't say his name, and I'll say it in a second. He wrote for alt-right white nationalist publications under pseudonym, and he published this terrible book called The Origins of Woke. He also earned a PhD from UCLA. in 2018, and I used to see him, you know, in political science. No disrespect for the discipline, but, you know, in 2010, Hanania, in 2010, he wrote, "If the races are equal, why do whites always end up near the top and blacks at the bottom, everywhere and always?" He wrote, "For the white gene pool to be created, millions had to die. Race mixing is like destroying a unique species of or piece of art. It's shameful." Hanania also wrote a recent statement on social media. He said, "No, Daniel Penny getting charged, these people are animals, whether they're harassing people in subways or walking around in suits." And it's ironic because Hanania would not be considered white by MAGA standards because he's Palestinian Christian of Jordanian descent. Okay, so one of the points I want to make here is that when Trump issues an executive order ending illegal discrimination and restoring merit-based opportunity and accuses DEIA of violating federal civil rights laws and undermining American values of hard work, excellence, and individual achievement in favor of unlawful, corrosive, these are his words, or the statement's words, corrosive and pernicious identity-based spoil systems. We know it is a lie because they don't believe it. And if you need proof that they believe in a merit-based opportunity system, all you have to do is look at Trump's cabinet picks, right? They don't believe in merit-based. Think about that. Or look at Daniel Penny's job offer. You know, no skills, and yet he's got this gig. Besides, if the Trump Project 2025 people really believed that white men are real victims of racism, then they would not dismantle the laws, institutions, and agencies designed to address discrimination. In fact, what they would do is repurpose those institutions that are designed to address discrimination for the purposes of protecting white people. But what they're doing instead is claiming the right to be racist and to use the levers of the state to reinstitute a form of apartheid or Jim Crow. And instead, they turn to fiction. And, you know, the amount of fiction that comes out of these executive orders and comes out of the mouths of all these people, it's astounding to me, you know. But Trump's most recent executive order claims the Smithsonian Institution is, quote, under the influence of a divisive, race-centered ideology that promotes, quote, narratives that portray American and Western values as inherently harmful and oppressive. Of course, no one teaches that. Restoring truth and sanity, according to the order, means accepting race as a biological reality. Now, I want you to follow me here. He's arguing, or I shouldn't say he, the people behind Trump, the whole Project 2025 people, the people who go back to the bell curve, are actually arguing that race is a biological reality and not a social construct. The very idea that race is a human invention, according to Trump, is a dangerous lie. And of course, that makes perfect sense given the logic, because if you believe that diversity or difference is immutable, and that there's a kind of a hierarchy, then you have to believe that race is biological. You can't believe it's socially constructed. Now, promoting ableism is a central part of their plans. And as we know, it's foundational to fascism. It's as important as race, right? Ableism. The able body is a metaphor for the nation. They're obsessed with masculine energy, with trad wives. They continue to defund medical research, dismantling the EPA, shielding corporations from liability, from anything, from pollution, manufacturing chemicals like herbicides, like Roundup, workplace injury, firearms manufacturing, and just deregulating all that. And all of these assaults are on people with disabilities. And of course, don't be surprised when they start proposing, you know, forced sterilization, which is a universal fascist policy. Now, Trump's anti-trans orders harken back to the Lavender Scare of the 1940s and 50s, which intertwine homophobia and anti-communism and resulted in a kind of in the purging of at least some 5,000 queer people from federal government jobs. And in fact, if you count the numbers, way more people were fired as a result of being gay or lesbian or being accused of being gay or lesbian, whatever, than communists. You know, the Lavender Scare was way more devastating in terms of people's lives. Nevertheless, you know, and this is in some ways the Trump era is a combination of those things. Trump issued at least 6 anti-trans executive orders, banning what it calls harmful gender ideology, declaring there are only 2 sexes, collapsing gender identity under the category of sex, requiring that all official documents, such as visas and passports, use only the sex assigned at birth, barring trans people from sports and the military, punishing schools for supporting trans students, prohibiting federal funding for gender-affirming care for anyone under 19, or any medical schools, for that matter, or hospitals that research transgender health. So if you take all this stuff together, these bans essentially facilitate the destruction of trans people as an identity group, stripping them of any federal recognition or any legal protections. And you know what that's called? It's called genocide. That is the definition. The Lemkin Institute for Genocide Prevention and Human Security has already warned that Trump's executive orders and the policies that follow, quote, are in line with a genocidal process against the transgender community. And the last one I want to talk about is this police state we're living under. One of the functions of the state that DOGE has not slashed is the coercive arm. Law enforcement, you know, with the exception of the FBI, and that's a very specific thing, and military continue to enjoy strong financial support, but the administration has practically eliminated any sort of accountability or police misconduct. So on his first day in office, the same Trump granted clemency. The same day that he granted clemency to nearly 1,600 felons convicted of crimes associated with the January 6th insurrection, he rescinded Biden-era police and criminal justice reforms. He restored the federal death penalty, made the killing of a police officer a federal capital crime, and directed the Attorney General and the Secretary of Homeland Security to establish Homeland Security task forces to be made up of federal, state, and local police officers. Under the guise of fighting violent crimes, it serves as a deportation force. It raids workplaces, apartment complexes, neighborhoods, and universities where it has abducted and jailed foreign national students just for protesting the genocide in Gaza. So by executive order, Trump also created the DC Safe and Beautiful Task Force. Think about that. DC for District of Columbia. Headed by who? The racist Stephen Miller. And the task force will coordinate local officials to deport so-called illegals, increase the overall police presence, and speed up the processing of applications to carry concealed weapons. You think about what that means, right? So we're witnessing the consolidation of a fascist police state, although, and then this is one of the points I want to make right now, is that for some of us, this has been a permanent feature of life. So Langston Hughes, who in a speech in 1936 said, "Fascism is a new name for that kind of terror the Negro has always faced in America. You know, this kind of terrorism is extending more and more to groups of peoples whose skins are not black." Now, Hughes, of course, was not alone in understanding fascism in this way. Black radical intellectuals, you know, had located the roots of European fascism in the colonial order long before Hannah Arendt or Jean-Paul Sartre and others had made the same argument. And you know, after World War II, the publication of Aimé Césaire's Discourse on Colonialism, where he argued that the real crime of fascism was the application of colonial procedures to Europeans, which, quote, until then had been reserved for the Arabs of Algeria, the coolies of India, and the blacks of Africa. And he observes that Europeans tolerated Nazism, this is a quote, before it was inflicted on them, that they absolved it, shut their eyes to it, legitimized it, because until then, it had been applied only to non-European peoples. Think of it, he continues. 90,000 dead in Madagascar, Indochina trampled underfoot, crushed to bits, assassinated, tortures brought back from the depth of the Middle Ages. And my favorite quote from Du Bois from The World in Africa, where he writes, there was no Nazi atrocity which Christian civilization or Europe had not long been practicing against colored folk in all parts of the world in the name of and for the defense of a superior race born to rule the world. In other words, fascism was not some aberration from the march of progress. It was the logical development of Western civilization itself, a civilization based on racial classification and hierarchy, on colonial domination, capitalist exploitation, and violence, the violence that comes with it, dispossession, enclosure, slavery, state regulation, and state regulation and reproduction. So settler colonialism is an expression of this incipient fascism. That's what we're talking about, the long durée. The fascist state never portrayed itself as against the people. It claims to be an expression of the people partly to protect us from those who are not the people. You know, so in other words, the people are those who are outside the people. Those are the others, black people, immigrants, Jews, Roma. And we can call this anti-democratic democracy. It's always grounded in the production of racial difference and is foundational to settler colonialism. Therefore, from this perspective, fascism is not at odds with liberal democracy. In fact, Michael Hanchard shows in his book, The Spectre of Race, every modern democracy was founded as an ethno-national racial state. Every single one. Think about it. Every modern democracy was founded as an ethno-national racial state. That means the exclusion, subjugation, and persecution of some other are not the people, right? So we're talking about democracy for the people. It's not always for all the people. The rise of fascism and the global economic crisis was the context for the radical turn in black scholarship. And, you know, you've got W. Du Bois writes the Black Reconstruction in 1935. C.L.R. James writes History of Negro Revolt, the Black Jacobins in 1938. You have the writings of Louise Thompson Patterson, George Padmore, Claudia Jones, Marvell Cook, Ella Baker, Richard Wright, and so forth. They were all produced in response to fascism and the growing anti-colonial movement. And as Cedric Robinson argued decades ago, the confrontation with fascism led these same intellectuals to study and examine black revolt through a kind of limited Marxist lens, forcing the best of those to adjust that lens, right, and therefore contribute to a new understanding of expressions of black resistance. The black left saw fascism on the horizon because it was familiar to them. They knew it. They recognized it. They were what they used to call premature anti-fascists. So when the American ruling class was celebrating Mussolini for crushing communists and labor and bringing about stability in Italy, right, African Americans and the diaspora as a whole was resisting that. If I can go to the next slide, I think. The mainstream press, right, this is the U.S. press and the Western press generally, they loved Mussolini. They loved him. They ran admiring and fawning articles on Mussolini and the success of Italian fascism throughout the decade, even into the mid-1930s. So we're talking about Fortune magazine, Time magazine, owned by Henry Luce, Business Weekly, Survey Graphic, Barron's, The New Republic, and the Saturday Evening Post ran a bunch of articles. In December 1927, issue of Nation's Business, which was the official organ of the Chamber of Commerce, its editor, Merle Thorpe, published an editorial titled That Man Mussolini. And he wrote, and you know, he's in love with Mussolini. He says, I can understand why a businessman would admire Mussolini and his methods. They are essentially those of successful business, executive action, deeds, not words. The impression you get of Mussolini is that he is a fine type of business executive. He cuts through, not fine-spoken theories, not plans, not speeches he's going to make, none of these. things done, and that is your successful American executive. The president of the New York Stock Exchange, E.H.H. Simmons, praised Mussolini for defeating communism, which he called, quote, that evil disease from the Orient. And that's something to remember. J.P. Morgan loaned Italy like $100 million in 1926. So fascism, to sum up this part, or what Mussolini called corporatism, proved to a certain extent to be capitalism's savior. So what are the characteristics of fascism? Abandoning democracy and civil liberties under the guise of the state of emergency, an authoritarian state built on an ideology of racial destiny, which justifies internal violence, that is, ethnic cleansing, racial cleansing, and external expansion. And note that all fascist and authoritarian states pursued some level of imperialist ventures, every single one. Brutally suppressing strikes and outlawing labor unions is another kind of element or component of fascism. In other words, making workers dependent on a coercive state. But let me just say a couple words about Italy to illustrate my point about the colonial roots of fascism. So bear with me. So like a lot of Europe, basically almost all of Europe after World War I, Italy, you know, ended the war in debt, high unemployment. You have strike waves everywhere, especially in Turin, working class insurrections, often led by socialists, communists, and anarchists. The Liberal Party was in power in Italy, but lost control of the economy and the country. Mussolini, who was a former socialist, got to remember that, who left his party because of his opposition to nationalism. Just a side note, the most amazing thing about the Italian Communist Party and Italian socialists is that they held on to internationalism. They resisted the war, whereas a lot of the other socialists in the Second International, they became nationalists right away. So Mussolini's pissed off about that, so he forms the Black Shirts, these paramilitary squads made up of disgruntled veterans. They attack socialists and communists. The Liberal Party had a choice. Now, they could have collaborated with the Communist Party or the fascists, and they chose the fascists. Liberals make bad choices. I'm just saying. So trade unions called a general strike in 1922. The fascists crushed the strike, marched on Rome, and basically seized power because they were not interested in collaboration with the Liberal Party. The Liberal Party just capitulated, saying, well, here, you got power. So Mussolini's now in power. He's set to rebuild the Roman Empire to restore national pride. So what does he do? Well, he already has Libya, so he invades Ethiopia. Now, we have to pay attention to the brutality of Italian colonialism because one of the big myths about Italian fascism is that it was more benign and not as racist as, say, the Nazis. The fascists did come to see themselves as a race, right? A Mediterranean version of Aryans. And while they did not organize Jewish death camps to that degree, they practiced fascist violence in the colonies. But even before the fascists, and this is the most important thing I really want you to take away with this, before the fascists came to power, right, Italy, like all imperial countries, waged a brutal genocidal war in the colonies. So during the Italo-Turkish War in 1911, Italy colonized Libya, which had been a part of the Ottoman Empire. Under the Liberal Party, that Italy's occupying forces gassed and starved Libyans, created concentration camps, ultimately killed one-tenth of the population. In 1935, jump forward, the Italian military used mustard gas on Ethiopians in violation of Geneva protocols of 1925, which banned its use, killed 250,000 Ethiopians within 3 years of the war, and by some estimates, one-third died from chemical weapons. And this may sound familiar, they bombed Red Cross hospitals and ambulances. They massacred prisoners of war. Italy's occupation of Ethiopia lasted until 1943, And Italy did not formally recognize Ethiopia's sovereignty until 1947. But the biggest issue to me is that the Western countries were very quick to recognize Italy's occupation of Ethiopia as legitimate. And war crimes